yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 05-1188-LL. Public Citizens, Inc. Petitioner versus National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, et al. Mr. Nelson for the petition. Mr. Ryerman for respondent NHTSA. And Ms. Jones for intervener, aligned with Automobile Manufacturers, Inc.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Nelson, representing petitioner Public Citizen in this action, and I've asked to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. At this point, I think that there's a general lack of disagreement among the briefs on the proposition that risks on the order estimated by Dr. Jerry Coffey in his affidavit are sufficient to support standing. There is disagreement, of course, about the validity of those particular risk estimates. But before getting into the minutiae of that, I'd like to step back and address some other propositions on which I think there's some agreement that that may actually obviate the need to delve into precisely where on the spectrum of risk these particular challenges lie. And to frame that, of course, as the court is aware, Dr. Coffey has estimated the incremental risk attributable to the choice of a 25% below placard trigger for a TPMS as compared to the T and RA minimum trigger, which we advocate, as involving a number of risks that he's calculated. I'll focus on one for the moment. 3.3 in 10,000 risk of accident annually.
What does that mean?
What that means is this, that there's a rate of
no,
a number.
What does accident mean? It was property damage, right?
Vehicular accident that involves some damage.
Well, if you have a flat tire and you have some damage to the rim, does that count?
I think if it's damage to the rim, that could count. But damage to the tire itself, I think, is not sufficient to bring it within that category.
Yeah, well, that was my next question. How can you be certain of that?
How can you be certain of that?
Yeah. And I suppose
I'd have to
is underinflated and it starts wearing on one side, that's property damage.
That is actually property damage. That's a separate category of injury that is calculated by NHTSA. But those, I'm quite confident, are not reported by and counted by NHTSA or by us as accidents. An accident, I believe, is something that gets reported typically to the police. A flat tire, I don't think, qualifies there. In any event, if I can proceed, the point I want to make with respect to that figure, 3.3 in 10,000, it's certainly on an annual basis much greater in magnitude than the 1 in 129,000 to 1 in 200,000 risk that was at issue in NRDC. Now, NHTSA itself estimated.
I wonder about NRDC. You know, there's a common phrase that your chances of being chosen for the to be nominated to the Supreme Court are like getting hit by lightning, right? The chances.
Well, that may be true of some people. Some of us, I think it's significantly lower than that.
Do you know what the chances are of getting hit by lightning?
I actually looked that up. The odds of being killed by lightning.
No, hit.
Being hit by lightning on a lifetime basis, I saw a figure of 1 in 3,000 for that.
Yeah.
How is that?
Pardon me?
It's as high as 1 in 3,000.
Right, over the course of a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, it's significantly smaller than that on an annual basis. I think there are about...
Well, it's 1 in 200,000, I think, on an annual basis.
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Which is why I wondered about NRDC. I mean, you know...
Well, you know, being hit by lightning is an interesting example for this reason. Colloquially, it's used to describe an unusual, if not random, event. But when you learn a little bit more about it, I think you learn that, number one, it's not as unusual as you might think, and number two, it's not random. It's the sort of thing that a reasonable person would take precautions to avoid because it is, in fact, a calculable risk. A lot of people get killed and injured by it, and there are things you can do, like, for example, not standing out in a river with a fishing pole in your hand in the middle of a thunderstorm. And that's advice that I would give to everybody in this room. And the reason for that is that reasonable people take precautions to avoid risks of that order. They are non-trivial risks. And I think that is what the court means or should mean when it talks about a substantial injury for purposes of standing in a risk-based scenario.
How does lifetime risk square with the concept from which all this is derived, which is imminent injury?
Well,
shouldn't we be looking more at annual injury than lifetime risk?
I think what imminent means, and we learned a little bit more about this, I think, in Massachusetts versus EPA, is it doesn't mean something that's going to happen tomorrow, but it's something that is, in the words of the case law, certainly impending once an action has been taken. And I think consider this possibility. Waste is put in a particular mountain in Nevada, and it is certain that once it's put there, if nothing else is done, it's going to reach the groundwater in 10,000 years. That because that risk is certainly impending once the action has been taken, it was held by this court to satisfy the definition of imminent, even though in the usage that I think some people might think of when they think of imminent, something that's going to happen tomorrow, that might not qualify. And in NRDC, as I understand the facts there, although I'm sure this court knows more about them than I do, the release of methyl bromide was expected to cause effects, calculable effects, on the ozone layer that were going to happen within a fairly short time after its release, but that were going to continue to have effects that, once it occurred, could not be altered. For many years to come, people exposed to the rays of the sun during that time were likely to receive that injury.
Well, the injury was also the alteration of present behavior by people who were believed what the NRDC said, that those people would take actions that would change their life immediately, is not to go out in the sun as much, put on sunscreen, cover yourself, and so on. I mean, that was the allegation.
I understand that was alleged in the affidavits in NRDC, but as I read the opinion, the injury that was focused upon was not the avoidance measures, but the measurable risk of skin cancer over that interval. All that being said, Judge Kavanaugh, In fairness, I think it's conceivable that in some instances where one might predict that there are other things that might happen over the course of a lifetime that would render a particular risk no longer applicable, it might not be reasonable to use a 70-year lifetime to calculate risk. On the other hand,
it does seem odd.
Where you can expect that an agency action such as the establishment of this safety standard is going to have continuing effects at least for a period of years, It's arbitrary to confine the risk to the next 365 days and cut it off at day 366. And I think, you know, in the time horizon in which we're talking about for automotive safety rules and the lives of vehicles and tires that will be subject to those rules, you know, I actually was pondering this question on the plane as, yesterday, and thinking that perhaps a time frame in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 years might be more more realistic for this type of a risk, but certainly a 1 year would be arbitrarily short. And in any event, in this particular case, I don't think we really have to worry about that because the 1 year risks are sufficient. That's, of course, if you accept Dr. Coffey. But one point I want to make is that even NHTSA's calculation of the benefits of using the TNRA standard was that about 731 accidents would be prevented a year. If you divide that out among a population of 300 million, that in itself works out to about a 1 in 410,000 risk in a year. And if you extrapolate that over a reasonable time frame, even under NHTSA's estimation here, you get into a range that is comparable to that in NRDC. So we've got an action that we're advocating that everyone agrees would raise tire pressure significantly. Everyone agrees that tire pressure is a significant causative factor in deaths and injuries. And the range in which we're talking about, the estimates on either end, while very different, are both sufficient to get us into the zone of something non-trivial, something that somebody would reasonably worry about and would potentially take action to prevent, I think is what we're talking about, and I think that standard satisfied here. Unless the court has any further questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Can you just address the replacement tires issue and the 0.5?
Sure. One point I'd like to make is if you look at the pages in the joint appendix that have been cited on that 0.5, the 0.5 estimate the agency acknowledges does not consider one of the major factors, one of the three major factors that the agency understood would cause replacement tires not to work. Those three factors being run flat tires, certain tires with steel in the sidewalls, I believe, and tires with high carbon content. The 0.5 only considered the first two. So it's clearly an underestimate. And the 1 to 10%, I think if you read what the agency's saying here, that's, as the court read it initially, predominantly attributable to the replacement tires. And they sort of threw in, you know, miscellaneous malfunctions probably won't take it out of that 1 to 10%. But again, even at 0.5%, that's a 1 in 200 chance that somebody who has one of these systems will go in, buy a tire, find it incompatible, and incur non-trivial economic costs.
Can I ask one further question, which is, what if, on your view of the facts, that would satisfy NRDC, on respondents' view of the facts, wouldn't? What are we supposed to do in that circumstance? What do you suggest?
Well, you know, there's little in the case law, as I'm sure you're aware, to address that other than Judge Randolph's opinion in Massachusetts v. EPA, which to me seems applicable here as well. You know, I think as the court said, it would be folly to try to have fact-finding proceedings in this court in every instance in which a petition for review implicates these kinds of issues, which, you know, I think after this case, it would be predictable that a lot more of them would. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's not the agency's business to determine the jurisdiction of this court, nor would the court be bound by anything the agency had to say about it. I think what I would propose is that you know, the court look at the standing affidavits, look at whether facially they seem to make a coherent case for standing, and you know, not try to become a trier of material facts. But again, in this case, as Judge Randolph pointed out in Massachusetts v. EPA, it becomes an easier question when the standing questions and the merits questions have a relationship, and in this case, they do, since one of the principal merits issues is the issue of underestimation of benefits of the rule that we advocate. So, you know, I think the approach that one would take there is to say, you know, if the petitioners are correct on the merits, they certainly have suffered a substantial injury, and then we go on to address the merits. Unless there are further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Your time is actually essentially up, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for a month.
Thank you.
I think you have 9 seconds or 8 seconds left. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Even I can't do much with that, Your Honor.
Or afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Thomas Byron for the government. And I'd like to begin by looking at a more fundamental question than some of those same minutiae. And that is that the challenge here, the claim here about standing, is fundamentally related to the merits challenge. And yet the problem here is that petitioner's standing claim is based on a theory that they didn't present to the agency, and therefore that is not within the record. And this fundamentally distinguishes this case from both NRDC and Mountain.
They don't have to establish standing in the agency, so they're not necessarily required to do that. Are you suggesting that we impose a requirement that you put in what's necessary for standing before the agency?
Not in every case, Judge Kavanaugh, but let me explain why this case or cases
and
like
certainly
it.
Certainly not retroactively, I wouldn't assume.
No, but I don't think there's any requirement or concern about retroactivity, and let me see if I can explain why. What petitioners are doing here is very much like what was at issue in Massachusetts against EPA, and for that reason I think Judge Randolph's analysis there is significant, and I want to touch on that a bit more in a moment. But first let me say that where the merits challenge and the standing challenge essentially merge or are so closely interrelated like this, ultimately the review by this court on the merits, if standing is shown, has to be on the basis of the standard of review in the APA, which is incorporated in the Safety Act. For that reason, it's fundamentally incompatible with that merits review ultimately for the court to apply some different standard of review at the standing stage.
I don't understand that.
Well, Judge Sentell,
I see no reason why our review of the merits would have to have the same standard as our jurisdictional review.
I agree
that the agencies, as Judge Kavanaugh suggested, have no standing before. They're not an Article III tribunal.
I think
there might be all sorts of jurisdictional questions, standing, rightness.
Yes. And you're absolutely right, Judge Sentell, that they don't have to be identical. What I'm pointing out here is that the fundamental difference between this case on one hand and NRDC and Mountain States on the other hand is that in those cases, the merits challenge did generate an agency view, a government view, about the level of incremental risk, of additional risk, that the parties agreed on. And in those cases, this court looked to the government's view on the record about what that risk was. And there was thus no question about this disparate review problem that I think creates this institutional concern
That's
reflected in Judge
you're
Randolph's.
You're troubling me again with the word disparate review. I don't know what that means.
Judge Sentell,
I'm to do a West search to see if that term's ever been used before. Anybody has ever had before?
What I'm trying to get at, Judge Sentell, has to do, I think, with Judge Randolph's analysis in Massachusetts against EPA, when the court recognized there that the problem is typically viewed as on an analogy to summary judgment standards, but that there's a reason to believe in direct review cases like this one from an agency that it should be more like that final trial analysis. But that's improper, Judge Randolph rightly pointed out, because this court does not review an agency order in the same way it does a district court order. And thus, the problem is that where the agency has provided on the record its views, and someone tries to attack them outside the normal parameters of agency review, you have institutional concerns that arise. Those include separation of powers concerns, of course, which reflect some of the reasons why, for example, a remand to an agency to determine standing would be wholly inappropriate for a number of reasons.
What if there's just a flat-out factual dispute? If in a particular case you think the petitioner's version of the facts is correct, then standing. If you think the respondent's view of the facts is correct, then no standing. Mm-hmm. What are we supposed to do?
Well, Judge Kevin, I think there's a couple of ways that situation might arise. And some of them are really fundamentally just
facts. Well, it could just be a battle of experts over a particular risk.
Right.
What are we supposed to do?
And here,
on my hypothetical.
Here, the kind of disagreement between the parties has to do less with the kind of fact questions that can be answered with a true or false kind of answer, as the court said in a different context in Florida Audubon. And instead, they have to do with the kind of methodological or analytical approaches to a problem and ways of resolving statistical differences. So those are not necessarily the same kind of questions that, for example, judges and juries in trial court are normally found to resolve.
But to get back to my hypothetical, suppose there's numbers. There are numbers by the petitioner, counter numbers by the respondent. On the petitioner's view of the numbers, yes, standing. On the respondent's view of the numbers, no standing.
Right.
What are we supposed to do?
This court has a range of options. Unfortunately, none of them is very good, as Judge Randolph's opinion pointed out. You can't remand it to the agency. Separation of powers precludes that, and it wouldn't make sense anyway. You shouldn't use a special master or some other adjunct proceeding because it doesn't really absolve the court of its own responsibility.
So then we should assume standing?
Well, I don't think so, Judge Kavanaugh, because the court's case law in both this court and the Supreme Court is very clear. Lujan says it, Florida Audubon says it, American Chem says it, that you can't assume the underlying facts of standing. They have to be shown. So the question is, what happens in the event of uncertainty, right? And in that case, the burden of proof, I think, provides the answer. The petitioner bears the burden of both production and proof in this context. The court's case law is equally clear about that. So if there's any question in this court's mind about which is the right answer, that burden of proof has to be answered, to be concluded.
That makes us the fact finder.
I'm afraid it must, Judge Kavanaugh, yes.
And in this case, we don't have my hypothetical because there haven't really been any numbers that have been put forth by respondents. So we don't have really the battle of experts. All we have really is the very extensive declarations put forth by petitioners and then some methodological attacks. But where are your numbers? I would have expected to see some numbers in response.
Well, this is what I was getting at the outset, Judge Kavanaugh, and that is that NHTSA here found that there is no relationship at the most fundamental level between tire pressure reserve on one hand and tire failure on the other. No relationship. That's the number that's relevant here. Because in the absence of such a relationship, there is no increased risk. The number is zero, Judge Kavanaugh. That's the answer.
How about on the replacement tires?
On replacement tires, again,
it's not zero there.
Well, perhaps it's not. One of the problems is that the agency.
On your perhaps, how could it be zero?
How could it be zero? Well, one of the ways it could, as
when
the court itself.
Perhaps, I assumed you were suggesting to us that there's a possibility at zero.
I think there is.
I don't see that possibility, so explain that.
Well, one of the number of uncertainties at stake with replacement tires is what will be the conduct of both tire manufacturers, tire dealers, and vehicle owners in the coming years as the market accommodates these new TPMS technologies, and everybody realize what works and what doesn't. Whether tire manufacturers will continue to make and tire dealers will continue to install tires that don't work with TPMSs is a very uncertain proposition. I don't think anyone believes necessarily
that
there's will.
So the manufacturers are going to do more than required by the agency.
Well, remember, this is tire manufacturers, not auto manufacturers, and so the tire manufacturers in this respect are not regulated by the agency. They're not required to produce tires that that work with TPMSs.
Right.
So this is a slightly different question, but let me just say that the agency concluded there was really no good way of knowing how many replacement tires wouldn't work in the future. Because remember that half percent, and the best estimate of 1% that includes other malfunctions as well, mm-hmm. is based on a technology that doesn't include a malfunction indicator lamp. That malfunction indicator lamp will tell drivers, who will then tell dealers, tire dealers, that their tires don't work. And we don't know what's going to happen then. The petitioner claims that those drivers will just go on with the MIL illuminated because they won't want to pay some nominal amount to have the tires replaced. Well, it's not certain who will have to bear that cost, first of all. But secondly, this is going to be an evolving issue, and no one knows at this point.
Well, since you're coming here now and saying there's zero is the most likely number, I'm surprised you didn't contest standing in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, one of the reasons we didn't is because the question that this court asked in the June 15th opinion was, what's the difference between the rules adopted and the rule that petitioners requested? Now, there was a great deal of uncertainty in the merits briefing stage about what rule petitioners requested, both with respect to the trigger for TPMS activation and with respect, for example, to replacement tires, in which petitioners before the court at that time took widely varying views about the relief that they requested. But with respect just to the trigger, remember, Public Citizen before the agency sought only a 20% under placard as opposed to a 25% under placard remedy.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up and we'll hear from the intervener.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I'm Erica Jones, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. Turning first to replacement tires, if I may, the problem with the evidence presented to you by the petitioners is that they did not answer the question you posed. You asked them to quantify the difference between the rule they got and the rule they wanted. As we pointed out in page 19 of our supplemental brief, the rule that Public Citizen wanted, the only petitioner remaining in this case, was a list of compatible replacement tires. They did not dispute that in their reply brief, and they did not quantify for you anything with respect to the difference between the rule they got, which is a malfunction indication, not a disabled TPMS, I might note, a fully functioning, but functioning in a different manner than the primary intent of the rule, and the rule they wanted, which is a list of compatible tires. We don't know what the difference in harm is. They don't dispute that in the reply brief. And that means that, therefore, they have not established standing for the rule they wanted versus the rule they got. Turning to the trigger issue, the 25% down, I have to disagree with Mr. Nelson's assertion that Dr. Coffey estimated the difference between a 25% down trigger and the rule they prefer. In fact, he did not do that. What he calculated for death and injury estimates was a comparison of two hypotheticals, a hypothetical fleet where every car has a tire reserve load of 2 PSI, and compared that to a hypothetical fleet where every car, wooden truck and van, has an 8 PSI. But 2 PSI is not the rule they got, and 8 PSI is not the rule they asked for. So that comparison is meaningless. And that means we don't have the battle of the experts, and we don't have to reach the difficult question of fact-finding. They have not answered your question, and they have not documented the difference between the rule they wanted and the rule they got. With respect to crashes, not injuries and fatalities, but crashes, they used a different method. He did not use this 8 PSI versus 2 PSI theoretical. He came up with a multiplier, a fraction that has an invalid numerator, as our expert pointed out, over a denominator that is a valid observational number that NHTSA observed, that is how many vehicles in the fleet would actually get a warning under the rule that they adopted, and NHTSA said that's 27.5% of the fleet. Dr. Coffey came up with an artificial theoretical number of 58% that he likes better, that comes from a 100-car study that has never been identified to the record, to the agency, or to this court. We don't know if those are 100 exotic vehicles or 100 mainstream vehicles. We don't know what they are. We have no idea.
And the percentages are not on the basis of how many of these vehicles are on the road. It's just the percentage based on 100 different makes of vehicles.
Well, it's 100 different make, model, model year combinations. It's 100 randomly, well, I won't say randomly. I'm sure they didn't choose them randomly, but 100 make, model, model year combinations that we have no idea and you have no idea.
Some of them could be Rolls-Royce, there's a handful of Maserati, and then the Honda Accords are in the other could be in the other column for all we know.
They might not be in there at all. And for that reason, that 58% number does not represent 58% of the fleet, although Dr. Coffey told you that it did. It's a meaningless number without the underlying data for us to contest. And putting it in a new, it's, in any event, it is a theoretical number based on how many vehicles in that 100, whatever the 100 car set is, how many of those vehicles at 25% down would be below the TNRA handbook. That number does not take into account the actual loading of vehicles in the fleet on the road. NHTSA did take that into account and said that it's on the road, only 11% of vehicles are actually operating overloaded. The reason there's a difference between those two points is that most vehicles are not operated at their maximum load, but Dr. Coffey's 58% assumes that it was. He says in his reply he didn't do that, but that's not true. He, in fact, did assume that they were operating at maximum load, and he said so in his opening declaration.
He said on paragraph 62, the tire pressure must be able to carry the maximum load because vehicles are normally used at maximum load.
That's correct. And then when we challenged that in our brief, he denied that he's made that statement and said he was not assuming maximum load, but in fact he was, and those numbers are based solely on maximum load. That's what that handbook is all about. So because these numbers that have been offered to you do not answer the question you posed, you don't have to reach the troubling question of how to deal with a true disputed fact.
And what's your answer to how we would deal with such a troubling question?
Well, I endorse the litany of horribles that Mr. Byron presented to you. You cannot go back to the agency.
Right.
That would violate separation of powers. A special master doesn't really help you because ultimately it comes back to you. That's not an Article III judge. You have to make the decision. So I think you have to be a fact finder. As Judge Randolph said in an earlier opinion, you don't hold evidentiary hearings to make facts findings. That doesn't mean you don't make fact findings. It just means you do them with the best evidence you have available to you on paper, and you reach the best judgment. Fortunately here, since you were very clear in your June opinion as to the roadmap you wanted the petitioners to follow, and they didn't do it, you don't have to confront that hard question.
Thank you, counsel. We will give the petitioner back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
First, with respect to the statement that the counsel for NHTSA made, that the agency had determined that there was no relationship between tire pressure reserve and any benefits, that's incorrect in one sense and misleading in another. It's incorrect in that the agency actually did calculate reductions in fatalities, crashes, and injuries that would be attributable to establishing a tire pressure reserve. And the numbers were 4 fatalities a year and 731 accidents. I don't recall the number of injuries right off the top of my head. But second, remember what they said was there's no relationship between reserve. But they did acknowledge, and the whole notion that their rule has benefits is premised that there is a relationship between tire pressure increasing and benefits. And there's no question that the trigger that we propose, which is higher than the trigger that NHTSA uses, would necessarily result in increased tire pressures. So there's an inconsistency in their position that there's no benefit. With respect to the point about the replacement tires and the claim that we haven't established a benefit or an injury that is relative to the rule we propose, number one, the rule that we propose is either that the systems work with all replacement tires or that there be a list. In either event, the injury of people going in and getting tires unintentionally that don't work is avoided. So the injury very precisely correlates with the remedy that we are seeking. As to the criticisms of Dr. Coffey's analysis, first, his accident or tire failure reduction method that involved the 8 PSI versus 2 PSI reserve is based on, as he explains, a reasonable estimate of the different reserves that would be in existence under the two sets of rules, not under an assumption that every car has those.
Time is up, if you can. And one more sentence, if you need it.
The only other point I would make is that on the 58%, which is the basis of the simple ratio method, it actually does not rely on any assertion about how often cars are used at maximum load, and the statement that they are normally used was an observation that that is a normal use. And I think if you look at both the original affidavit and the supplement, it is clear that he was not. Okay.
You put it, Your Honor.
My colleagues have actual questions.
Thank you for the briefs that you all did under tight time frames this summer. We put you under tight time frames and appreciate that.
Case is submitted. Give us recess.
Stand, please.